We have a platform that helps cities with their entire climate action planning and execution. So we help them set the goals and make sure they're aligned with the Paris Agreement, build their strategy, and then enable execution by assessing their actions, what kind of impact they can make, and very importantly, start beginning to assess the financial pros and cons of the transition.
Welcome to this special English edition of Der große Neustart, a German podcast series by Sibylle Baden, in which she talks to pioneering leaders who, inspired by the World Economic Forum's Great Reset initiative, are committed to making our world smarter, greener, and fairer.
Today, I welcome Thomas Schalit, CEO and founder of Climate View, and his community director for German-speaking countries, Michael Bergü. Climate View created the world's first platform to support climate decision-making across entire city economies. Based in Stockholm, their technology enables local governments to understand and monitor their emissions, choose the best pathway to net zero, and collaborate at scale to implement a comprehensive transition plan. Why is this important? More than half of the global population are urban and generate more than 70% of global energy-related emissions. Only recently, said the UN's General Secretary Antonio Guterres, cities are where the climate battle will largely be won or lost. Climate View operates today in 170 cities across the world, 50 cities alone in Germany. And it's been named one of the most innovative companies in 2021. Welcome, Thomas and Michael, in Sweden. Let's begin with you, Thomas. To create a platform that is able to identify the most cost-effective route to decarbonize city economies, what does it actually mean?
Well, we have a platform that helps cities with their entire climate action planning and execution. So we help them set the goals and make sure they're aligned with the Paris Agreement, build their strategy, and then enable execution by assessing their actions, what kind of impact they can make, and very importantly, start beginning to assess the financial pros and cons of the transition.
Thomas, let's imagine I'm a client and I want a little more detail.
So you're a client, you come and start using the platform. And one of the first things you're going to say is, oh, but we need lots of data. Mm-hmm. We have to understand the city's current baseline. And then we'll say, fine, that's good. We will start with providing you your baseline of all your city's activity. And we do that through different models where we take national statistics, we scale it down. We give you a good starting point and assumption of your current baseline for your city. Then we provide you with transition elements, which are kind of like building blocks for your strategy, where every transition element is a model, a KPI that describes one kind of transition. So now let me take a step back. In the future city, the one we want to build, the one we want to create, we still want to live in comfortable, well-tempered houses. We want to travel to work. We want to eat nourishing food. What we need to do is shift the mechanisms with which we fulfill these needs. So we still want to go to work. We want, instead of taking internal combustion engines, we want to cycle or have EVs or walk and cycle or use remote working. We still want to live in well-tempered homes. We want to shift the way in which we heat them or cool them or how efficient we make those buildings. We want to eat nourishing food. We want to go from a plant-based, from a meat-based diet to a higher degree of plant-based diet. So I'm saying all these things, we know about cities. And the great thing is that these patterns are very similar across different cities. They have the same kind of challenges and they have the same kind of transition opportunities, because each one of these shifts I described is an opportunity for the transition. So I'm going back to, you asked me, what does one do? Well, I said, you get the baseline, but then you get a collection of more than 100 transition elements, each one of them describing one of these transitions as and the opportunity it gives, and the costs and the co-benefits and the behavior drivers needed to create that transition. So you get like a palette of strategy components, strategic building blocks to build your climate action plan. And with that, we have saved a lot of time for cities, because the great thing is cities are very similar. So these building blocks that we have built now over several years can be shared between different cities. Mm. So if you get going, you come and you start using our software, we give you first the baseline assumptions of what carbon driving activity does your city have today. Then we give you this palette, these hundreds of transition elements, which you combine to build your climate strategy. And then you start, then we give you tools to start adding projects and actions to help you fulfill your strategy and connect them to your strategy. So you can start assessing if you're doing enough to reach your strategy and your goal.
That's absolutely fascinating. You do the full package, don't you? You give us a tool, you analyze it, and you help in the transformation. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. And it is, I think it's a very important thing that it is the full package, because traditionally, many of these things have been done and done well before, but they've been spread out. There's spreadsheets over here. There's some kind of emission inventory over there. And there's lots of good government and other material on different kind of transitions. All of these things exist today, but they're spread across many different tools and many different places. So we are bringing together our platform where all of these things are integrated with each other. So you have a one place where you can do everything.
And from what I understood, this platform shows me categories like transport, buildings, what's going on there. Is that correct?
Yes. So these transition elements I spoke about, which are these building blocks, they come in different sort of piles. We have a picture of a periodic table, which might be a good image to have in the head. So when it comes to, say, mobility, there's a number of transition elements which are strategic building blocks for your mobility. When it comes to building, there's a number of transition elements. And when it comes to energy supply, which is, of course, very, very key, there's a number of different transition elements that describe the shifts needed in our energy supply.
Mm-hmm. You were talking about these complex activities. So a city has thousands of complex activities. The amount of data, how do you break it down?
So in several ways. So first of all, when it comes to understanding the carbon driving activity in the city, that is the kilometers being driven, the square meters being heated, the square meters being built, etc. Those we break down according actually to standards that exist out there, something called the GPC protocol, the other different standards. We fulfill the different standards, and that breaks down the activities into what we call carbon causal change, the kilometers being driven and the carbon emissions and other emissions they cause. So that's following standards when it comes to describing the current picture of the base of the baseline. And then we have the transitions. And that's where these transition elements come into pieces. So each one of them is like imagine a box, and in which it describes, say, shift. Let's take a simple one, shift from cars to cycles. Now that by itself contains lots of data. It contains the understanding of what are the emissions from cars and what are the emissions from cycles. Well, a lot less. What will the benefit being of shifting those kilometers from cars to bicycles? What is the average commuting trip by car and by bicycle? What kind of behavioral drivers do we need to make people make the choice to take the bicycle in the morning instead of the car, etc. So each one of these, the way to handle this massive amount of data is, as always, modularity. And the modularity here comes from these transition elements, which each one of them contains then a large set of data. But you want to sort of be able to peel it as an onion, look at the element as a big block, and then you open it up and there's more data, and you open up a small box in that, and there's even more data. Mm-hmm.
Michael, before we come to you, I have just one more question for Thomas, because you were saying that's how we want to make people change their behavior. So how do you make people change their behavior?
That's a very good question, because that's so much, such an important part of the transition. So we can actually see that the transition is about changing behavior in a sense, in a sense, like I'll go back to the same simple example, to make people go switch to bicycle, they are actually making a large amount of decisions there. How comfortable is it? How do I feel safe when I cycle to work? If I don't feel safe, I'm not going to cycle at all. How much extra time do I add to the distance? How do people socially look at cycling to work instead of taking the car, etc.? So there's a number of behavioral drivers, which actually pretty well mapped. It's not that we need to invent these. These exist. Lots of really good research and reports describe these behavioral drivers. What we have done is inserted them into these transition elements in a clear model where these things are well defined. So for every single shift, you can define a number of behavior drivers. And to be really sort of see the pattern really clear, it's always about behavioral shifts. Even if it's like cycling, that's a new decision that you need to make every day. But if I have a district heating station, I'm going to decide on spending billions on some kind of CCS, it's still a question of what are the underlying what are behavioral drivers for me to make that decision in that investment? Obviously, they're obviously much more rational decisions, but it's still a set of behavioral drivers for that decision maker to make that investment in carbon capture or whatever they choose.
Michael, over to you. You are in charge of the entire German-speaking market. And I noticed that in Germany alone, you operate in 50 cities. How come?
Thanks, Sibyl. But maybe just to finish the point of Tomer, of course, there is not only one solution. So I think that is actually also something that really works well in Germany and other places as well. So I mean, we now took the example of biking, but of course, it's always there are several transitions that need to happen. And what our tool does is telling a city what is technically possible, but then of course, then come the political priorities and what is socially acceptable. And maybe in some places, biking is really the city of Heidelberg or Freiburg, maybe some university cities in Germany, biking is very popular, where in other places, not far away, there's still a very strong car culture. So maybe the shift to electric vehicles or other modes of transport are more popular, and the city can really set their priorities and really choose their optimal pathway to net zero. So just to finish off that and transition over to the point, yeah, why is it going so well in Germany? It is because there is a long tradition of tackling climate change at the local level. I mean, some cities have started working with it in the 90s, and Germany is a federal state, so cities have a lot of power and responsibility. And then, of course, 2019 happened, Fridays for Future, Greta Thunberg, Luisa Neubauer, the civil society kind of finally woke up and put a lot of pressure on the politicians. And what we're seeing now, of course, so this is now 3 years back. Like always, political processes are slow, but we're now seeing kind of the trickle down effect of that. So from the streets to the elections, so since then, many local elections have taken place. Power, let's say, the majorities are shifting towards the climate or the climate issue is very prominent nowadays, and of course in the end it goes down into budgets, and we notice that on a daily basis. So the climate office receives much more support these days, and the civil society has woken up. I mean, there is I mentioned Fridays for Future, but for example, there's also German Zero, which is a grassroots organization which provokes a lot of local initiatives, in German called Bürgerentscheide, so that cities raise their ambitions, set clear targets, 2030, 2035, according to the Paris Agreement. Well, we all know that's probably even too late for the 1.5 degree target, but nevertheless, cities feel the pressure from the street and also now need to achieve progress faster, be more transparent in their approach, include relevant stakeholders, and that's where we really can help them with our decision making platform for the entire city organization.
Michael, can you take us perhaps in with a bit more detail through a city's successful transformation in a way that our listeners understand exactly what to expect when they approach you?
Let me take the example of Heidelberg, where, of course, they have a very active civil society. It's a university town. They're a little bit pressured by civil society and other stakeholders. Say, guys, do you know the clock is ticking? We need to be carbon neutral very, very soon. So they came to us and say, well, we have we have that idea that they put a watch on the city hall saying like how much time is remaining till our carbon budget is running out. And of course, the city then said, well, you know, we can do that, but it's not a very positive message. It looks like we're doomed in 2 years. Mm. Let's try to turn it around and have something more constructive. And that's where they turned to us and said, well, maybe actually the dashboard that we're offering could help them, you know, could help everybody to see the solution. So when they approach us, we try to answer the following questions for them, like, oh, Tomer said a little bit before as well, like, where are we now? What are our missions and where do they come from? So they can really, we help them answer first that question. So where are they today? Then where are we going? What is our goal? What are the sub-targets? What is the pathway that makes most sense for the city? Again, you know, balancing out the different interests. Some put more emphasis on biking. Some others are more on electric cars. Some don't need to decarbonize the district heating system. It's already taking place. Some others really need to get rid of the coal. Or the gas heated energy or gas generated energy in the system. So there are really different potential that they can start working with. And of course, what do we need to do concretely? Like, what actions have the biggest potential in addressing emissions from this sector? What actions drive behavior change? We talked about that. Mm. And how do we get the buy-in? How do we communicate our plan? So it's not just just came off a talk with another city in the Hamburg region. How do we make this a collaborative effort? We sometimes jokingly say, well, this is like a big group exercise, like you know, back in the days in school, you put together a random group, and of course you have the nerds, you have the cool people, and you have also the slackers. And in a city, it's very similar. And in the end, you need to make everybody aligned, or at least push in the right direction, or in the same direction. And of course, and then also what is very important for German city, measure progress, monitoring, you know, how do we, and they're also a little bit, we try to tell them, well, you know, the inventories that you do, they are tedious, they're hard to understand, you don't break them down into concrete, at the very concrete level. So we were working with leading indicators and what can be done to close these gaps. So those are the questions we try to help them answer when they approach us.
Mm-hmm. Back to Toma. When local governments come to you, do they come always with a clear target, or are they wary? And I'm asking that because you highlight on your site Newcastle in the UK, and they seem to be very clear and driven to reach net zero by 2030. Is that the normal case?
Mostly, I would say, obviously, the cities that we started working with in the beginning were obviously the most ambitious ones. So most cities have some kind of target, but not always. Sometimes we have to help them assess and find a good target. But I would say most cities have a clear target.
Mm-hmm. And Michael was mentioning they have a dashboard. Mm-hmm. So how do I imagine the dashboard in the mayor's office? How does it look like?
Imagine it's an interactive climate action plan.
Yeah.
So that you, at the top level, you see the current emissions and how we're going, and you see the projections of where you want the emissions to head. And then you start double-clicking and you dive into more and more detail till you come to each one of these transition elements, each one of these transition opportunities, and there you get a detailed breakdown saying we want to shift this many vehicles to EVs, or this many vehicles to cycling, or retrofit this many buildings, etc. So the very concrete physical change of the cities, yeah. And you see the effects of those, and you see all the actions in place to try and achieve these goals, these targets, and you also see the target attainment, how well you are reaching those targets. So it's an interactive dashboard where you get the big picture, but then you can, as interactivity lets you, double click all the way down to nitty gritty details and then zoom up again.
Yeah. So you're basically aware all the time of the current status.
Yes, you're aware of the current status and aware of where you should be heading and where the end goal is.
That's more a question now for both of you. In your experience over the last few years, what has been the biggest CO2 contributor?
If a city has a big local industry, like you can have a small city which is supplying the entire nation with steel, in the example where I'm from, then of course that's the far biggest one. But if you remove those sort of national interests that are local, so to speak, then, because they will obviously go over the top, but then it's nearly always, it's transport and building. It's about 30% of transportation, and other 30% is building.
One issue we see coming more and more is obviously the indirect emissions, the scope 3 and the consumption-based emissions. So because that's also a little bit of a funny thing. Tomer, you can talk about Sweden that's moving exactly as an entire nation into that direction. But in Germany at the moment, the greenhouse gas inventories are not taking into account any of those imported emissions. And they're not taking into account even the industry emissions sometimes. So it's in a way we're working with a very incomplete picture. In our tool, of course, you can assess all your emissions. So that we're not very prescriptive, but just to say, so this is now a topic we're seeing more and more, because some cities, there is just not much left. Well, there's a lot of left to reduce in mobility and stationary energy, but if we start to take into account the indirect emissions, the consumption based emissions, the picture looks again very different. So we create a lot of spillover effects from our consumption patterns. So that is one thing, and also another thing that we're seeing more and more also in German cities, but also elsewhere, is to combine climate mitigation with adaptation, and also looking at co-benefits between those kind of two distinct but still interrelated disciplines to make cities, you know, greener. Tomer said at the beginning, we want to have livable cities, great cities to live in, and of course that's a combination of contributing to the overall climate challenge or climate crisis or finding solutions to mitigate CO2, but of course also make it a livable place in the summer, for example, and the asphalt square is definitely not a good idea in that respect. So cities are also working more and more on making their cities greener, and also adjust to the floods and everything. There's the strong weather events that are coming our way and more and more.
Mm. I'd like to go to your question there on like the biggest emissions from cities, and then starting to look outside the territory, so to speak, and the consumption-based emissions. The very interesting thing is there is that cities actually have a lot of control over some of them. They might not be able to directly tell their citizens what to eat, but for example, cement is really where a city is probably, for many cities, where they have absolutely biggest control over, like how to choose to build. And it's not today calculated in their emissions inventory because it's outside. The cement is made somewhere else. So that's one of those examples where really looking at consumption-based emission makes practical and moral sense, and is very much under the city's actual remit of what they can do a lot about.
Mm. And when I asked you the question before, you immediately went into where the transformation works best. Mm. So where does the transformation work best? In getting rid of the emissions.
Yeah, so I guess there's several answers. Here's what everyone wants, the silver bullet answer for this. And of course, the big challenge here, there isn't a answer. We actually have, in many ways, going from centralized solutions to very decentralized. But there are some easy wins, which many, as in the transport sector, which is beginning to happen quite fast with electrification, and where technology seems to be catching up. There's a lot of things that can be done in building, but where we have chokes in the form of how much retrofitting, et cetera, can be done. I've just seen now in Germany, for example, it seems like heat pumps is like beginning to pick up properly. But no, there isn't a silver bullet. It's a question of using less energy, using energy more efficient, and then making sure we change where our energy is coming from. So no, there isn't that one big bullet. I mean, the reason people love talking about electrification is because that is a big one, which is kind of easy to imagine. And yes, let's all drive electric vehicles. It doesn't feel like a big difference. But we also know we can't all drive electric vehicles, and that's not the silver bullet. Mm. We need to drive less as well.
And just briefly, if you okay, you have your dashboard there, everything is in place, and suddenly the results come up. And what is if local government does not know how to deal with it? How much outside intellectual support do they need, and how much can you do?
I think we can do most by connecting cities to each other. It goes back to where we started, that cities' challenges are very similar. And by having a common language on how to address these transitions, mm-hmm. and the common language is about these transition elements, about behavioral drivers that we all share, about the models that we all share. So the best way is helping cities work together and get their help from each other, because every city is a specialist in one thing, at least.
Mm-hmm. And here I can add an example from Sweden, where actually one of our very early cities, Umeå and Eskilstuna, not the biggest cities in the world, but the climate front runners, they have actually granted each other access to their board. So each one can see what the other is doing, and of course, learning and discussing. And yeah, not reinventing the wheel every time. That's a little bit because that's actually sometimes what we see, what's holding cities back. They try to reinvent the wheel or just to copy paste without a proper discussion from other cities, because you need to adjust it to local circumstances. And our platform always helps. So it's like, you have an iPhone, I have an iPhone, I don't know how to use that app that you have. Yeah, I can ask you for advice, because we're running on the same operating system.
Thanks, Michael. Toma, what we haven't done is we haven't talked much about your technology in detail yet, but I'm quite curious about, have you developed it all by yourself? How does it look like? What makes it special?
So first thing, I think most when we say a web-based tool, I think most people have some kind. They're using, yeah, if nothing else, Outlook in the cloud or something like that. So having a tool that you're using in the web browser to plan that I think that's clear. Now, then what's special here is the underlying models, what we call an agent-based model. So we've talked about these transition elements. Now we can look at each one of these transitions. Now, the thing is, of course, it's a really systemic problem. Everything is interconnected. If we shift to electric vehicles, obviously the way we change the energy mix is going to make that shift look very different. If we shift buildings to district heating, it depends very much on what kind of district heating we are provided. So every single one of these transitions is interconnected with others. And that is where that becomes, calculation-wise, can become a massively complex problem. That's where, yeah, like big Excel spreadsheets will not hold it. So what we have developed is a model where you can define every transition element as a building block by itself. That's not that hard. But then they start working with each other. And so when one changes, there's knock-on and lock-in effects. They all start interacting with each other. The user doesn't have to take that into consideration. So instead, they get what-if scenario planning. They pull in one lever and they see what happens elsewhere. They pull in another and see what happens elsewhere. And that's when you can get aha moments, yeah, yeah, where you understand how things interconnect. And actually, just the understanding, just being able to manipulate the complex system and pull in the levers, gives a deeper understanding of how the system works, a systemic understanding. And I think that is really important all across all stakeholders. So the politicians understand, so the civil, so everyone involved actually understands the system.
Mm. Toma, I would very much like to pick up on your thing that every transition is interconnected, and the complexity of systems, and that we all need to understand it. By 2050, we have over two-thirds of the world's population, they are said to live in cities. So changes need to happen now to reduce emissions and deliver resilient urban ecosystems, right? If we move from transforming towns and cities now to the transformation of the world's 33 megacities, like Tokyo. Megacities are cities with more than 10 million people. Tokyo, for example, as a metropolitan region, is home to 38 million people. So how would you approach it? And does your technology work here as effectively and efficiently as it would work in Stockholm?
So actually, we're beginning to have some experience of this. And the interesting thing is it's actually pretty similar. So even these mega cities, well, they are divided into sub cities, etc. And at that level, it's the challenges, the transitions are about the same. Then obviously the, you know, public transport where people live very densely is much more efficient and you obviously a higher proportion. But there's actually not that much of a difference in how you approach it. There's more people involved, there's more data, but the core approach is exactly the same.
So basically, me, the mayor of Tokyo, can also come to you and use your technology.
Yes.
That is fascinating. Really, it is. And you're also now coming from cities and towns to mega cities, you're also working with the government of Sweden. Mm-hmm. To turn the entire country into a what? Net zero economy?
Yes, actually, net zero economy by 2045. Sweden is using the term the first net zero welfare economy.
When I read about you, that was also your first client, wasn't it?
Yes. So a lot of this underlying technology and the framework with transition elements we developed with the Swedish Climate Policy Council, Energy Agency, and the Environmental Protection Agency. So going back to your question, but it was in the beginning, we said, let's build a dashboard for Sweden's transition. That was the starting point in following the idea that if we all have a shared common picture of where we are, where we want to go, what's going on, we will have a better ability to start aligning all the different stakeholders towards that common goal.
Mm-hmm. What we also haven't talked about yet is how do you finance your work? And that's a question for you, Toma, and also Michael, as let's go back to your Heidelberg example, how much does it cost me, the city of Heidelberg?
So the cost obviously differs on the size of the city, but also how much handholding or support the city needs. But let's say from small to bigger cities, we were talking about between 10,000 to 50,000, 60,000 euros a year, including obviously with a lot of support. So we take the service part of we were software as a service, so we take the service part also very seriously, because in the end it's a human-centered business. We provide technology, but of course it's humans that have to make the decisions collaboratively, and we support them in that. Yeah, but this is about the price range typically for a city.
It's also cities can get going, so we have a package which is completely free, so when it comes to the assessing your now, what we call the analysis, understanding where you are now, doing your carbon inventory, all those parts of the tool we actually let cities just use for free.
They use for free? Mm. How come? Because you have to finance this, don't you?
Yes, but this is a big, this is the yes, but the challenge of the transition is so big. Everyone has to move in the same time. And for us, The great thing about software is, of course, this is a way that the underlying idea with software is it's something that can scale, and this is a problem where we need to scale the solution for super fast. So by giving it, by letting cities having the starting point free and doing the kind of stuff to understand where they are, it just feels it's really good to be able to provide that for free. Then obviously we're assuming that some of the cities will like the package and want the more comprehensive, deeper features, and will continue to use it and with the paying tier. But to get started and understand and assess your current situation, that is just something that we really want to provide to everyone.
Mm. Would you like to give us a bit of an insight of your business model?
So business model is actually very straightforward when it comes to what one calls SaaS, software as a service, where you have a free entrance and then you have add more and more features and you pay more for the features as you add more of them. We are heading more and more towards the financial analysis. And this is actually, let's take one step back. The really interesting thing about the transition is that we know at a high level, I mean, I'm saying we as like people in the world know that at a high level, the transition has a positive return of investment. Mm. Obviously, if you calculate the cost of inaction, it always has a positive return of investment. But even without that, the transition has a positive return of investment. The challenge is, however, that you have winners and losers. So at a micro perspective, positive return of investment, but at a different stakeholder perspective, you have winners and losers. Understanding this discrepancy is actually what's guiding, what we need to know to guide our financial and our political ambitions. We can't say what needs to be done, but we can help to give the best possible insight to understand these gaps. Who are the winners? Who are the losers? Where do we need incentives? Where do we need unincentives, etc. So given that, it is the financial analysis of the transition which we think is the key to unlocking and make this transition happen fast enough. And the really great thing, and this has changed so much since we just a couple of years ago, is that we actually have lots of financial institutions that want to invest in the transition.
Yeah.
And we have cities that know that this must happen. However, they don't speak too well to each other just yet. They haven't learned each other's languages. And that is the bridge a bridge, basically. So coming back to our business model, the more we can help with understanding this financial situation and understand the climate, the investments needed for the climate investment, the faster we can accelerate the transition. And obviously, these kind of financial functions are something that cities are happy to upgrade to.
Mm-hmm. Because you went into those numbers and the different stakeholders now and the market, the entire ESG market has been growing so rapidly. I had my first conversation about it in 2019, and it was difficult because it was even difficult to describe because it was so new. By now, it's a $1 trillion market. And I found this morning in Bloomberg, they are saying that the global ESG assets are on track to exceed $53 trillion by 2025, representing more than a third of total assets under management. So we are not talking about a niche market here. No. Maybe this question is for both of you. This is a massive movement, but with a massive movement comes a lot of fear. How is there fear among your clients that, for example, they could lose out and it will destroy the current economic structure and it doesn't work out, and they, at the end, as a mayor or government leader, could lose their jobs?
I wouldn't say fear. And Michael, I'm looking at you because we're meeting different customers, but a bit of analysis paralysis, which isn't really fear. but it's like everyone sort of sees and understands and knows this must happen, and we are talking about the positive effects at a high macro level, hand waving high macro level. But then this has to be done into nitty gritty details in a balance sheet where you have the numbers down to the decimals if you can. And it is that going from yes, we know this must happen to where are the details, what are the exact numbers, that's a lot of levels to go through. And that the fear of analysis paralysis. It's not the fear of it will break the economy, etc. No, people know this must happen. It's like, but can we do it fast enough? Do we know enough? Do we have enough data? That's the fear.
Michael? I can add to that. I just talked to the city of Dresden yesterday, and they're one of the 100 mission cities for Europe, so they're at the front. But of course, very concretely right now, they're heavily dependent on gas, on Russian gas. So of course, they half the climate team is absorbed to prepare for the next winter. So probably the geopolitical and the market. Everybody knows we need to move fast, and exactly there is a certain analysis paralysis, sometimes also bureaucratic hurdles. Tomer talked about heat pumps, yes, but installing heat pumps in Germany is still quite a process. Installing your solar panels on the rooftop is still quite a process. So there are a lot of also bureaucratic hurdles that need to reduce, and I think that is. That is one part where we just have to be much, much faster and more pragmatic. And then the other part is of course, it's job creation. And of course, we're talking to cities which has a bit bet too long on the old industry. But they understand what's at stake. and in the end, it's a global competition for the best job. Who's going to build, who's going to build the next big industry for batteries, for solar panels and so on. But we're also seeing that those jobs are coming back to Europe. So I think many European cities are well placed, but it's a global competition. There's not a fear, but they know what we need to do, and we need to do it fast. And of course, they need support from all levels. Digital tools can help, but of course, also the right policy frameworks from federal governments. They can help a lot. Revising some of the laws that make it so difficult to install some of the solutions we have, remove those obstacles and get going. And that's what we're hearing from cities.
Mm-hmm. And you are right now in 70 cities, is that right?
170 cities.
170.
Or globally, we are in 170 cities, exactly.
And how fast did you move from the introduction of the technology to now?
So, of course, we did a lot of, as Thomas said, we started in the nation of Sweden. And of course, we very fast saw that our technology can be used in cities. So we started with some Swedish cities. So probably for the first 2-3 years, we worked around with 30 cities with those front runners. You mentioned Newcastle. We learned a lot from them. So what we have today is co-developed with cities. So we really that's part of our DNA. We develop our softwares together with cities, run prototypes, get their feedback, improve. So really to create the best software possible for the climate officers and the entire city's organization to use. In the last 12 months, we've seen a massive scale up in numbers of cities, also numbers, of course, of colleagues nowadays that joined. And that's partly because we removed some of the barriers to get started. So as Thomas said, a lot of cities could start for free, starting putting their inventory, kind of see a little bit how the tool works and the transition pathway. But we're also word to mouth kind of feedbacks from city to city, cities that are talking about us to other cities and say, hey, you should, have you seen this and that? And we're also creating a new segment. So far, I'm speaking mostly for Germany, where I know best. So far, we have had several inventory tools. Inventories are the best in the world in Germany, but nobody has really taken care of the next steps in the city's transition journey. And that's what we're doing. And we're creating a new market. And maybe we're one of the first movers, but we're also seeing some other other startups moving into that space. And that's great. So cities actually have a choice and that kind of keeps the wheel turning. And that's, I would say that adds to the massive scale up over the last 12 months.
Mm. Thomas, do you have an aim? You want to be in X amount of cities in X amount of time?
Our aim is about carbon reduction. So that's the aim, and so cities follow. So I say the aim is about carbon reduction, and that's what guides us, and making sure that we funnel that finance gets funneled to the most optimal carbon reduction, and of that follows, yes, we need many more cities, and we need big cities, and we want to work with the ones which have the highest potential, etc. But it's carbon reduction that's the goal.
And the 170 cities you're in right now, are they divided on all continents, or has it been basically Europe and America?
It's Europe and America mostly. Then we have some really like, because that's where we work most, but then we have some interesting outliers which are like coming from other continents, but basically that's where we're focusing.
Mm. Are you working together with the United Nations? With a sustainable development goal?
No, not sort of in an official capacity, but we obviously very much, obviously goal number 13 is like what we're thinking about all the time. So, and we have, you know, we meet them in all kinds of capacities in different places. I think we'll find ways.
Because it would be, I mean, quite efficient, wouldn't it? If the, let's say the UNDP as the biggest organization there has all access to all countries and all cities, would say, look, we got that example here and we could, or you want to be totally free.
I think that it would be. Here's one of the reasons also why we even started the startup. One wants to find a way to combine the really fast moving, start very, very flexible startup sort of pace where together with big organizations and NGOs. So it was a fantastic start with the Swedish government because we got a really great combination of government agencies, Vattenfall and us, a small startup. We want to be fast and nimble as a startup. And at the same time, we are all the time building towards the needs of these big organizations. So there will be, it will meet up. But yeah, it's for us to find the right balance of being flexible and adaptable.
Almost always the starting point is the city. So we do get requests from cities, for example, in Africa, big cities, mega cities, Lagos in Nigeria. And of course, very often you end up then with UNDP or with one of the big industry networks like C40 or ECLE. There's a whole thing, but it's also, I worked in the sustainable development goals before, and it's quite a jungle. So at the moment for us to start, sometimes it's just easier to get the conversation started with cities and then build it from there. Mm.
Looking back, Toma, you are actually a mathematician, right? And you have been a successful agile consultant before. So why? Did you decide to take a big risk and dive into this net zero economy?
Oh, simple. And it's the same reason I think most people, everyone in our company works with what we're doing. Basically, thinking like, you know, with the knowledge and the profession I have, how can I make, you know, when I was, you know, stopped flying and stopped eating meat, with the knowledge and the profession I have, how can I make the biggest possible difference on climate? It was that simple, like, question. How can I make a difference? And I think everyone that has joined the company has joined us in, you know, it's software engineer or whatever, has joined us thinking, okay, where can I, with my profession, do the biggest difference on the most important problem of all that we have?
Mm. And Michael, what led you to this profession? Because you have a bit of experience already, as you said, with the SDGs and United Nations. And so... Tell us about it.
Yeah, so I've always had an interest in development questions, of course, mainly human, economic. Why are some countries developing better than others? So, of course, a strong focus on the developing world, Africa, South America. And at the same time, I love to be out in the nature. So I used to be a scout, and that's probably where my interest for environmental question comes also. And then... Well, throughout my career, I haven't done too much thinking about what am I going to do next. I always knew I want to work with something I have a passion for, and I somehow managed always to end up in jobs that I really, really like. And then I ended up at ClimateU because I moved to Sweden with my family and I didn't have a job. And then I met those guys at a job fair and said, oh, this sounds interesting because it combines climate and sustainability with something I haven't worked at all in, is a tech company. So I'm learning still every day. And I think that is, that's how I ended up, kind of maybe with a bit of curiosity. And also probably I'm one of the outliers here because I've worked with those topics throughout my career. Many others have not. And actually it's such a privilege to work with people that kind of finally get on the right train, but have that immense knowledge and skill level that we can all bring it all together. So that's I'm definitely in the right place here, and then enjoy the ride.
Mm. My experience in the last 2 years working and talking to people who basically want to make the world a better place, there is a new great energy. Is that, Toma, you're nodding? Is that your experience? Is it?
Yeah. Yes. It's so much. So recruiting tech talent, for example, should be hard. For us, we are getting such fantastic talent coming aboard, even for we're sort of in Stockholm, which is one of the most competitive places. People are really coming in with really clear mindset and energy of of wanting to do something important and feeling they can do something. I think the energy comes from feeling, because either you get analysis paralysis or you refocus that energy to really feel that you're doing something, and that gives energy.
Yeah. And the ones who actually put their mind on it really have so much energy. It's really a completely different world. I have the privilege to dive in. I mentioned in the intro the quote of the UN Secretary General Guterres, who says, cities are where the climate battle will largely be won or lost. Toma, how are we doing in a battle?
Well, actually, it's interesting. Cities' goals are often more ambitious than national goals. And we're really encouraged by the city's determination to go green. There's really such a strong willingness and creativity to do this. And I think just the fact that, how fast we've been able to scale over the last years really shows that. So, I could say emissions are still going up. I could be like a glass half full. But if I say the ambition and how the really big difference in talking to cities now and just 3 years ago, I could see hope in this battle.
Mm-hmm. Lovely. And still, we do have to talk about it because there is, it is a massive industry. Yes, it is going forward with an absolute exceptional speed. And we have Paris, Glasgow, Stockholm, the SDGs, the ESGs, the Green Deal. You have your sensational dashboards for the government. And still, humanity seems to be almost unwilling to move towards this direction. And I'm not just talking about now the war in Ukraine and the energy market. We see it on all levels. It's a question for both of you to answer, and I would like to start with you, Toma. What does it take to actually make the change? We have everything, we just have to make it now. What's the missing link?
So we have everything when it comes to the big picture. We have everything when it comes to ambition. We have everything when it comes to the knowledge that tells us we need to act. We don't have everything yet on exactly what needs to be done. So for me, one of the missing links, there's not a missing link, but one of the important missing links is the hardcore grit of breaking things down into exactly what needs to be done, or rather what can be done so as to move to the next step, to then figure out what needs to be done in the next step. So the devil is in the details. And for me, there's so much like you come to a city or you come to a nation and we all agree, but then it's like hand wavy, high level pictures, and we need to break it down. And I actually think it is very important to understand, as we talked earlier, the costs and the benefits of the transition, understand how this picture looks, and do understand that there are winners and losers. There's no way around that. But understanding that picture, being completely transparent about that picture, is it's so we have the big picture in place, but we don't have the full decision intelligence to take the daily decisions that we need. Mm-hmm. And the answer to that is like not have the entire picture, but having what we need to do to act today and tomorrow so that we can move forward and then continue to move in the right direction.
But you mentioned a very important thing, which is who is the winner and who is the loser?
Ah, and that's okay. Well, that's a very big question. So we need, obviously in the high levels, we'll have the, you know, let's take the big energy companies, which definitely are part of the transition, but they don't want to transition too fast because they will have stranded assets, mm-hmm. making simplified picture here. But you have the same thing down to, you know, somebody that has just bought a new diesel car. This thing thumbs up to a new electric vehicle in 10 years time when my car is old or whatever. So the winners and losers are on all levels. And that's what makes it so hard.
Okay, Michael, sorry. coming back to the question, do you still have it? Do you know what we talked about?
Oh yeah, what's the missing link? And I think that now on a very operational level in a city, I mean, Tomer mentioned it in part, it's the finance. That's what I'm hearing. We're talking to any city. I mean, I don't know any city in the world that can finance the entire transition out of their own city budget. So they need external funding. They need extra investments. And you at the same time you mentioned the ESG market is growing. Well, there are some, you know, there's some definition problems about ESG. But I don't want to go into that detail on that. Let's call it the impact investment market. They are ready to finance projects, and cities do have them, but they don't speak yet the same common language. The climate officer, well, even within the city, the climate office and the treasury, they speak once a year when it comes to, you know, adding a budget line for project X and Y, and maybe adding another colleague to the climate team, but they don't talk the full cost of the investments yet. And that is where we, for example, try to help close that gap. Basically teaching the climate officers speaking more the language of investors or help them prepare some of the process that are bankable or investable to be kind of ready lifted out into the market so that this transition can be faster. And of course also sensitize the investors and the treasury and kind of the financial providers about the needs and fears of a city organization, because they're not, I mean, take the example of Germany, there are very, very few green bonds. Has also historical reasons. The banks are very big. Let's say that the administration is taking its own speed, whereas in the UK or Sweden, new public management or whatever Margaret Thatcher has done in the 80s to the government in the UK obviously kind of instilled also a need to look elsewhere for funding, whereas in Germany it usually comes somewhere, funding comes through a subsidy, and that is also a link we're trying to close with our platform, kind of bringing those actors together in a common language, or what we call, Tomer, you can expand on that if you want, on the impact intelligence reporting, to kind of really have like an executive summary that kind of speaks both the language of climate people and also investors.
Mm-hmm. We're coming slowly to the end, but I really want to need to know one thing, because you both mentioned it several times about not everybody is talking the same language and closing gaps and so on. Tomer, maybe you can sum it up. How do we create greater understanding and the will to change?
So continuously democratizing knowledge, and by doing that with a clear taxonomy and ontology describing how the transition needs to happen. So transparency is a key enabler. Mm-hmm. As I said before, I think at this point, the world understands what we need to do about the climate challenge. Now it comes down to action, and action comes down to financing. And if we show the path ahead, the viable path, the viable economic path ahead, if one can be transparent about that, so that's well understood, then the pressure to change will be even bigger.
Thank you, Thomas. That sums it all up. It was a delight talking to you both, Thomas and Michael, and I wish that your technology will be distributed all over the planet cities and reduce global emissions on a large scale. Thanks a lot and good luck to you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a special English edition of Der große Neustart, a German podcast series by Sibylle Barton, in which she talks to pioneering leaders who are committed to making our world smarter, greener, and fairer. For more information, please visit www.sibyllebarton.com and the official site of the World Economic Forum.